Do you know what's going to happen in 18 months? Why don't you think about that? What happens in 18 months? I'll be a little more specific. 540 days from today, do you know what will happen? It's 2020 in November. November of 2020. No guesses? Yes. Oh, I heard it. What was it? The election. That's right. The 2020 presidential election, 18 months, 540 days from today. I can already see the disappointment and disgust on some of your faces as if to say, oh no, not again, so soon. And if you had thought that just maybe the campaigning that was going to happen over the next 540 days would be a little more civil this time around, well, I'm sad to say that you're probably going to be disappointed. Because in all likelihood, it is going to be worse. There are already 23 declared challengers from the Democratic Party, and many of whom have already been given degrading nicknames by our president. The trash talking has already started. And while the mudslinging is mostly limited currently to social media, it's not going to be long before attack ads fill the commercial gaps of our nightly news, Wheel of Fortune, and your favorite show. But you know, political mudslinging is certainly nothing new. The first example is thought to have been in the presidential election of 1796, when Alexander Hamilton accused Thomas Jefferson of sleeping with his slaves. Probably the dirtiest presidential campaign in history occurred in 1828 that saw incumbent President John Quincy Adams supporters calling Andrew Jackson's mother a prostitute, his wife a whore, and Jackson a murderer and a cannibal. Jackson won that election, but the mudslinging had some consequences. His wife died of a heart attack that was suspected to have been caused by the stress of all of the accusations. None of us were alive back then, but we can remember what the presidential election of 2016 was like, that saw Hillary Clinton call Trump supporters deplorables and saw Donald Trump repeatedly call his adversary Crooked Hillary. And those were some of the tamer accusations, weren't they? We don't know what the 2020 election cycle will bring, but we do know this. It will be far from civil. That's kind of a strange word, isn't it, right? Civil. It's a word we don't really use all that much. Civility is defined as being polite, reasonable, having a respectful behavior. And strangely, incivility is something that we know more about, right? If you were to say, which is a more common word, civility or incivility, we'd probably say that incivility is a much more common term. And it's becoming increasingly more used more often because incivility is becoming increasingly more common. Incivility is most certainly on the rise. It is everywhere. It's in political campaigns, of course, but it's in our schools. It's in our workplace. One of the major topics in healthcare today is incivility in the workforce. You think about workplace violence, healthcare is the number one place where workplace violence occurs. Isn't that interesting, right? But in political campaigns, our schools, our workforce, certainly in social media and in our daily interactions, the number of people who say they've encountered incivility somewhere in their daily lives has increased 60% since 2016. I think that says a lot about our leadership in our country, that if you see leaders do something and get away with it, it entitles others to do the same. 1 in 10 Americans say that they have experienced an uncivil interaction in the past week. I suppose I could bore you with a whole bunch of statistics about incivility, but let me just say this. Incivility has lots of names. Rudeness, cyberbullying, workplace violence, road rage, all of those things are examples of incivility. It is all around us. But Peter reminds us in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, "But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light." God has called us out of the incivility of this world to be civil. This morning I'd like to talk a little bit about civility. As I was putting the lesson together, I thought, man, this sounds an awful lot like a sermon I gave in November of last year about being a peacemaker. And I don't know if it's just something about things that are on my mind, the things that I see happening around me that I think would be good messages. There are a lot of similarities there to us being peacemakers. We'll talk about that briefly. But really, we're talking about civility, our interactions with others. I want to center my thoughts around the passage that Christian read for us this morning, and that is the instructions that Paul gave to the Romans regarding Christian behavior. Specifically, it's the last part of Romans chapter 12. So I'll read it for you. We'll begin in verse 14. Romans 12, beginning in verse 14. "Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who weep and weep with those who Rejoice with those who rejoice, and weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind towards one another. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. Do not be wise in your own opinion. Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in doing so, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good.'" I want to focus on really two verses there in that group of verses. I want to start with verse 12, where we talk about bless those who persecute you. And then I want to focus on, if it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. This is really the verse that really got me thinking about this particular message. But let's start by looking at bless those who persecute you. This message was so important to Paul, bless those who persecute you, that he rephrases it and repeats himself just immediately after and says, bless and do not curse. And if you didn't hear him the first time, and you didn't hear him the second time, Paul says it again in verse 17, where he says, "Repay no one evil for evil." The message here is just a message that Paul is repeating of a message that Jesus had given. Right? In fact, in some ways, it's almost identical to the message of Jesus. In Matthew chapter 5, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says in verse 43 and 44, "You have heard that it is said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I say to you, love your enemy, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you." Peter likewise reiterates Jesus' command, just like Paul had done in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 and 9. "Finally, all of you be of one mind, have compassion for one another, love as brothers, be tender-hearted, be courteous. Do not return evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, blessing, knowing that you were called to this, that you may inherit a blessing." This message is so contrary. Jesus makes that point. He says, "You've heard it said, love your neighbors and hate your enemies," right? That's sort of the standard. That's the status quo. You like the people who like you, and those people who don't like you, well, you don't like them also. And this response, blessing those people who persecute us, is such an unnatural response. It's so contrary to what we want to do. Our natural reaction, I mean, think about it. What is your natural reaction when someone persecutes you? What's your natural reaction to pain? When you put your hand on something that's hot, what do you do? You pull your hand away. Our natural reaction to those who persecute us would be in some way to to withdraw from them, maybe to do like Jesus said, to hate our enemies. But no, we're told that we're supposed to bless them. This is really a good example of what Paul was mentioning in the first part of that chapter, Romans chapter 12, verse 2. This is an example of how we're supposed to be transformed rather than conformed. The natural response in the world is certainly not to bless those who are persecuting us. But sadly, too many Christians repay evil for evil. Paige and Reese often ask me what my sermon is going to be about. And I usually tell them something about an example I'm going to use. And Paige, what did I tell you my sermon was going to be about?
The Incredible Hulk.
Yeah, I told her it was going to be about the Incredible Hulk. I want her to pay attention. Because that response, right, when Christians, instead of responding in kindness to persecution, instead of responding with a blessing like we're told, when we respond in wrath, when we repay evil for evil, it's almost like it reminds me of the Incredible Hulk, right? He's that guy that is a normal guy, but says, "You don't want to see me angry." What happens when he gets angry? He turns into this giant green monster. And you know, that's what happens with Christians respond by repaying evil for evil. We might as well just be the Incredible Hulk. You ever wonder why we're not we're not allowed to curse them and make it difficult in their life? Think about that. Why would God not want us to curse those people who are making our life difficult? Well, consider the story that we're told in Luke chapter 9, verse 51 through 56. "Now it came to pass, when the time had come for him to be received up, that he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem." This is speaking about Jesus. "And he sent messengers before his face, and as they went, they entered a village of the Samaritans to prepare for him. But they did not receive him, because his face was set for the journey to Jerusalem. And when his disciples James and John saw this, they said, 'Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven to consume them, just as Elijah did?' But he turned and rebuked them and said, 'You do not know what manner of spirit you are of. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them.' And he went to another village." This is exactly why God doesn't want us repaying evil for evil. The apostles didn't see the picture, did they? This group of Samaritans, this village of the Samaritans, they didn't want to receive Jesus. And the apostles' response is, "Let's condemn them. Right? Let's call fire from heaven." And Jesus rebukes them, says, "You don't understand what spirit you're of. Jesus didn't come to destroy men's lives. He came to save them." So when you return evil for evil, what are you really saying? What is your spirit? Earlier this year, Emily and I were talking with Reese about another girl that she goes to school with that's in her same grade, but I think maybe in a different class this year. And it was just a normal conversation, and Reese piped up and said, "Oh, she's my arch enemy." Kind of a funny thing for a little girl to say. But I want you for a moment, I want you to think about your arch enemy. I want you to think about your nemesis. I want you to think about the one person in this world that you dislike the most. Maybe it's more than one person. You got that person in your mind? Think about that person who, of all other people on the world, you would rather spend time with anyone else but that one person. Now I want you to envision that person in hell. Do you want that person in hell? Do you want that person punished eternally in an unquenchable fire? I hope the answer is no. There isn't a person alive, no matter how much we dislike them, no matter how much I dislike them, that I would want eternally condemned. If Jesus can plead with God for his persecutors and say, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they are doing, then I too can bless my persecutors. This is the attitude that Christ demonstrated, and it's the attitude that he expects his followers to demonstrate as well. We see this in Stephen, right? It's mimicked by Stephen in Acts chapter 7, when at the end of his speech, and as he is being stoned, he says the same thing that Jesus says, or at least very similar. Verse 59, Acts 7, 59. And they stoned Stephen as he was calling on God and saying, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. And he knelt down and cried out with a loud voice, Lord, do not charge them with this sin. And when he had said this, he fell asleep. Later, Peter wrote in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 21 through 23, For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example, that you should follow his steps, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. See, Peter reminds us that we too, like Jesus, we're supposed to follow after him. That when he was reviled, he didn't return a revile. When he suffered, he didn't threaten. Paul, as the other disciples, lived by this principle and always sought to bless his enemies, just as Jesus did. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 12, Paul says this, As we labor, working with our hands, being reviled, we bless. Being persecuted, we endure. It's such a strange thing. It seems like so counterintuitive, right? But when we are persecuted, there's a level of compassion that we're supposed to have for our persecutors. And in that compassion, we are supposed to ask to bless them. And there's a reason. Remember what the reason is? It's there in Romans chapter 12, right? When your enemy is hungry, what are you supposed to do? Feed him. When he's thirsty, give him a drink. And what's the purpose? To heap coals of fire on them. Do something that will spark a, what is different about this person? Let's move on. Let's look at the next. Live peaceably with all men. In addition to not cursing our enemies, Paul also instructs us to live peaceably with everyone. This is civility, right? This is the definition of civility, to live peaceably. Living a peaceful life with those outside of the church is a common theme throughout the New Testament. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 9, Jesus says, Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. In 2 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 11, this is Paul's sort of ending of the message to the Corinthians. We don't know that he wrote to them again, so this very well could have been the last thing that he wrote to the Corinthians. But here he says, Finally, brethren, farewell. Become complete. Be of good comfort. Be of one mind. Live in peace. And the God of love and peace will be with you. See, civility, living at peace with those around us, is such an important thing that we're commanded to pursue it, right? There's some things we're commanded to run away from, but peace is one of those things that we're supposed to run to. In Psalm 34 and 11, Come you children, listen to me, and I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Skip forward to verse 14. It sort of lists some of those things we're supposed to learn. One of them is depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. Romans 14, verse 19. Therefore, let us pursue the things which make for peace and the things by which one may edify another. 2 Timothy 2 and 22. Flee youthful lust, right? There's one of the examples of things we're supposed to run away from. And what are we supposed to replace it with? Flee youthful lust, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. We're commanded to pursue peace. And why pursue peace? Well, Hebrews chapter 12, verse 14 tells us, pursue peace with all people. It's sort of the same message that Paul is giving in Romans, but now in Hebrews. Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. Why are we supposed to pursue peace? Why are we supposed to have peace with those around us? So that they can see the Lord. See the Lord in us. right? That's the example. But what is biblical peace? Well, biblical peace certainly is not the absence of conflict. Far from it, right? Remember what Jesus said, John 16:33. These things I've spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. Biblical peace is not about not having conflict. In fact, we're almost guaranteed conflict because we are a Christian. We are at war with the world in many ways. And Jesus tells us, you'll have peace with me and you will have tribulation in the world. There will be conflict, but we will still have peace. Biblical peace is not peace at any price, is it? True peace doesn't come through compromise with evil. It's not a negotiated peace, right? We don't say, well, you know, all right, let's meet in the middle somewhere with the world. That's not the peace of the Bible. In James chapter 4 and verse 4, adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. See, biblical peace is not compromised peace. No, not at all. And biblical peace is not an avoidance of issues, right? True peace doesn't come in saying, well, we'll talk about this more later. True peace doesn't come through kicking the can down the road and ignoring strife. That's not the same as peace. Biblical peace is the product of God's wisdom. In James chapter 3, verse 17 and 18, we're told, but the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, without hypocrisy. Now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. See, biblical peace is the result of wisdom in God. It's also the result of God's righteousness. Thus, peace is inherently connected with righteousness and is rooted in God's victory over sin. So why are we called to live peaceably with all men? Well, it's a quite simple answer. Consider what Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 19 through 23. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win the more. And to the Jews I have become a Jew, that I might win the Jews. And to those who are under the law, as under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, not being without law towards God, but under law towards Christ, that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became as weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. Now this I do for the gospel's sake, that you may be partakers of it, that I may be partakers of it with you. We seek peace so that we will have an opportunity to share our peace with God with other people. Because the truth is, there's no peace without peace with God. I mean, you might not have conflict, but that's really not the peace that we're talking about, is it? The other reason is in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. I guess it's sort of related. This is the verse that we're using as an opportunity to study in the junior high and high school class on Wednesday evenings. But you know this well. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, that you always and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you the reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. We seek peace with others so that when they see Christ living in us, when they see the hope that is within us, that they ask and we're able to give a response. And how are we supposed to respond? With meekness and fear. Fear not like being afraid, right? The NIV translates that word respect. And that's probably a good way to translate that word. We respond with meekness, with humility, and with respect. And so we live at peace, or try to live at peace and avoid conflict so that we can help others to Christ. And so how do we do this? Well, certainly we do this by forming a relationship. It's hard to be at peace or at conflict with someone who you don't know. Consider Titus chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. Here, Paul offers, I think, seven tactics as to how to be a civil person. Paul writes this to Titus, chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. Remind them to be subject to the rulers and authorities, to obey, to be ready to for every good work, to speak evil of no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing all humility to all men. Did you hear those seven tactics? Be in subjection to the authorities. Be obedient. Be ready for good works. Don't speak evil of anyone. Be peaceful. Be gentle. Be humble. If you can manage those seven things, then you will certainly have a better opportunity to live peaceably with all men. But there's a caveat here, isn't there? There's a condition. These instructions to be at peace with others are conditional, and they're conditional on two things: if it's possible, and as much as depends on you. Living peacefully and living civilly, being civil is possible, but living peacefully may not always be possible. Peace may not be possible for a couple of reasons. It might not be possible for the sake of truth. Peace with someone may not be possible because doing it might require us to compromise or recant some truth that God has revealed. We can't do that. That's not possible, right? We should not allow ourselves to make peace with someone at the expense of the truth of God. Jesus sort of makes sense of this in Matthew chapter 10, verse 31, where he says, "Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword." There will be conflict because of the truth of God. And we cannot compromise the truth just to have peace with someone. We can be civil, most certainly, but we aren't going to find ourselves having peace with those who are opposed to the truth. The second is that peace may not be possible with other peoples because they won't allow it. Whether between nations or individuals, peace is a two-way street. By definition, a peaceful relationship cannot be one-sided. Just like it takes two to tango, it takes two to make peace. When I was younger, my dad would always say something like this. He would say, "You don't start a fight, but what came next?" Anybody? You can imagine. You better finish it, right? That was my dad's message. Let's ignore the second half of that and focus on the first half. You don't start a fight, right? That's the Christian's attitude towards our relationship to those people in the world. We don't start a fight. In a way, what my dad was trying to say was the same kind of thing that Paul is telling Christians. It's our responsibility to make sure that we are not the unpeaceful, uncivil one in the relationship. That's our side of the equation. We can manage that part of it. Our side of the relationship must be right. We cannot be the cause of the conflict. Now, we can't control the other half. And that's why Paul says, as much as is possible and depends on you, you do your part. Unless it's not possible to do your part. If it's not possible because it means recanting the truth, then you can't be at peace with the person. You can be civil, but you can't be at peace. It was not always possible for Paul to live peacefully with all men. Remember in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 24 through 26, Paul gives a listing of all the times that he was at conflict with people. From the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus 1. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 I was shipwrecked. 1 and a night I have spent in the deep, in journeys often, in perils of water, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils amongst false brethren. Paul's life was riddled with times where it was not possible for him to be at peace with people. Remember in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 14 through 15, Paul calls out Alexander, right? Remember, he says, "Alexander the coppersmith did me much harm. May the Lord repay him according to his work. You must also beware of him, for he has greatly resisted our words." Paul doesn't seek to make peace with him. Why? Because Alexander resisted the truth. He made it miserable for Paul. And Paul didn't curse him. What did Paul say? May the Lord repay him according to his works. Even our Lord did not find it possible to live at peace with all men all of the time. Jesus himself overthrew the money changers on two separate occasions. And he warned his disciples in John chapter 15, verse 8, if the world hates you, know that it hated me before it hated you. And in the end, the Jews were determined to kill Jesus. But it wasn't on Jesus. Jesus did everything he could to remain civil and live at peace. Jesus nor Paul went about looking to start a fight or stirring up trouble. When they faced the difficulties of living peaceably with others, they made sure it was the other person who stirred up the strife. Let's look again at Romans chapter 12 and finish by looking at those verses again. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind towards one another. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate them with humble. Do not be wise in your own opinions. Repay no one evil for evil, having regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in doing so, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not overcome evil, but overcome evil with good. You have this opportunity this morning, as we do any time, to overcome evil with good. You know, there has been in the past, and there will be in the future, a lot of name calling through our politics. There is one name that each one of us wants to be called, and that is Christian. There is one way to become a Christian, through baptism in Jesus Christ, to overcome evil with good. If you found yourself overcome with evil and you need to make amends, or maybe it's primary obedience through the waters of baptism, you have that opportunity. Come as we stand and sing our closing song. 700.